few more minutes, but we'll go ahead and get started at this point. I think our TA may be joining us in a bit. So first of all, I personally noticed I had a little trouble myself, so I apologize if that happened to any of you guys. It was asking me for a passkey in the beginning, and I was typing in the right one, and then it didn't work, and then it reset. So I believe it was just because one person had jumped in, and then our TA wasn't the one to establish the meeting. So I think that was the issue. And anyway, we'll work that out. But anyway, at this point, since I'm already here and a bunch of you are, let's go ahead. So the only thing I would ask is, first of all, try to keep your questions, you know, pertaining directly to this week's material, at least in the beginning. So I'm going to be here tonight for a full hour, so until, what would it be, 8:30 Eastern time. Generally, the office hours are going to be longer, maybe like 2 hours, but tonight I have to go home and pack and everything. I'm going to a tea party event with my good buddy Jonah Goldberg tomorrow, so that's why tonight's is a little bit short. The other reason is, if you saw that email I sent, remember this Saturday I'm going to do an entire lecture one all over again because of the problems we had with some of you not being able to log in and see it the first time on Monday. Okay, so again, just to repeat, this Saturday I'm doing lecture one, the thing I did on Monday, again, and it's going to be a full 3 hour block. So my lecture will go for about, I don't know, an hour and 15 minutes, and then the remainder of the time, you know, for the full 3 hour block will just be me fielding questions. So that's the other reason tonight is only going to be an hour, but we know a lot of people might not be able to do it Saturday morning. If you didn't see it Monday, if you didn't see the lecture Monday, and you're not going to see it this Saturday in terms of the live, you know, logging in like you are right now, it will be, the recording will be posted. To my knowledge, and someone might need to correct me if this is wrong, I don't think we have the Monday's recording posted yet. And so we're looking into getting alternate backups, just so in any event, no matter what, Saturday's lecture will be recorded and posted, I want to say, by Saturday afternoon. Okay, so if the Monday's content will, or this, sorry, week one's content will be available by the latest, I want to say, by Saturday late afternoon. All right, so if you had missed Monday's lecture and you know you're not going to see Saturday's, that's the way you can catch up on it. Let me, people are still trickling in here, let me talk about just some housekeeping things that I probably will send out another email about this that I didn't catch in that first explanatory email. Just a few things, repeated questions as far as the grading goes. So, you know, you don't need to write this down. I'm going to send this stuff out in the email, but just to clarify what's going on. Yes, if you want to be graded in this, okay, that you're not just auditing it, you want me to give you a grade when this is all said and done so that you can, I don't know what you would do with it, go brag to somebody, I suppose, then you don't need to notify me. The way you signal to us that you want to be graded is you start taking the quizzes, okay? So on the Academy website, you know, the Moodle where you log into the Academy, the quiz right now, I believe you can view it, but you don't see the answers. You just see what the questions are. So it's going to be multiple choice, and that thing will go active Friday morning and be open all weekend. So if you want a grade, just to repeat, every week during the weekend, make sure you take that week's quiz, you know, pertaining to that week's material. And it's just a multiple choice. There's not that many questions, and you know, they should be, a few of them are a little bit tricky, but usually for all of them, there's a clearly correct answer. And then the other two, you know, one of them might just, half the time, is even a kind of a joke, right? So it's just to make sure you're doing the material, and it's basically keeping you honest, making sure you don't take a week off. So to force yourself to do it every week. So anyway, if you want a grade, you don't need to tell us separately. Or on the other hand, if you don't want a grade, you don't need to announce that. Just don't do the quizzes, and that will be a signal to us you don't want to have a grade. All right. The other thing about the grade, for those who want it, people have been asking, you know, is the how are we going to grade the participation in the forums? Okay, there again, don't freak out about that. It's going to be a very easy hurdle to get over. What we're going to do is simply, at the end of the course, you know, after we grade everyone's final and everything, and then we're computing the average to say, you know, we average in the quizzes and how do you do on the quizzes and how do you do on the final, we're just going to have a component that's 10% of your final grade being due to class participation. And all that's going to mean is that we'll just go through and look and see, you know, did this person participate in the weekly discussions? All right, so you don't have to do a bunch of posts and anything. All it will mean is we'll go through and just look and see, oh, yeah, he posted here, he posted here, he posted here. Okay, so it's not that if you post 8 times, you get an A, and if you post 7 times, you get a B+. It's not going to be that scientific. All right, but on the other hand, if we go through and we're like, gee, this guy posted 1 time in week 5 and that was it, well, then your 10% component of class participation is going to suffer. All right, so anyway, again, it's just to encourage you to pop into the forums. If a particular week comes and you look at the forum and you really have nothing to say, that's fine. You don't have to force yourself to say something for the grade, but you know, don't let 3 weeks go by without saying something if you want to get an A in the class. Okay, so that's, again, that's it. And the other point too is I'm not grading the content of the participation. So it's fine if you want to go out on a limb and say, you know what, Bumbaverick says this, but I think this, don't worry that I'm going to say, no, you're wrong, and I'm dinging you now in your grade, and you can only get a B+. That's not going to happen. So go ahead and, you know, as they say, there's no such thing as a stupid forum post, okay? All right, so at this point, why don't I turn over to you guys? That's what the point of this thing is. Let's see. I'm just looking over here. I don't see. Yeah, it's mostly just people joining. Okay, Grayson, I believe, is not on yet. Grayson, the TA. Okay, so I don't know if he got called away or if he's just having trouble getting in for some reason. So what that means is normally he would be here to sort of field the questions. So in other words, you guys could just have a free-for-all typing, and then he would pull it out for me and set it up. Okay. So what that means is I'm just going to be fielding these. So let me ask you guys. Fortunately, there's only about 33 of you right now that are logged in. So just try to be polite. So, you know, type a question, and then if I'm answering it, you know, wait for your turn if I'm not answering your question, okay? Because if this thing fills up and I'm trying to read the question, it moves off while I'm trying to read it, if you understand what I'm saying, all right? So anyway, why don't we let's just try that. So, okay, so I'm going to just jump right in here. Steven Handel, and what I'm going to do also is I'll try to keep my answers fairly brief, to accommodate as many of you as possible, and then near the end, if the numbers start thinning out, and you know you're still there, it looks like the questions have tapered off, feel free to, you know, to come back. But let's right now try to let everyone get their one question in, and then I'll elaborate later if we have time. Okay, so Steve Handel's asking, in one of Callahan's chapters, he discusses the dot-com bubble as a consequence of artificial savings. He mentions one lack of resources being a lack of web programmers, and he states, if enough people had been setting aside enough time to learn web programming form of saving, then perhaps there would have been enough programmers. However, I don't understand how this form of savings would affect interest rates. It's true there. It's not exactly clear how it would affect interest rates. It was a little tricky. So in general, the Austrian theory is it's not about money, it's about real goods and services. Okay, so when we talk about saving, I mean, if you think about like Crusoe on the island, and he wants to save up in order to finance a project. And incidentally, in case people would, I'm holding down a key here, so I'm going to be one-handed for right now because I'm holding down the talk button. You know, to say Crusoe, he has an idea, and right now he's living hand to mouth, but he wants to save up so he can invest in a capital good. What that would mean in the Crusoe context is he's picking with his hands, he's picking, you know, 10 coconuts a day using just his bare hands, but he only eats 9. So every day he's saving one. He's consuming less than his income. And so every day he adds one new coconut to his stockpile. So in that sense, he's saving and he's building up this fund. And then when he invests, you could say, well, what he's doing is in future days, he just starts eating his stockpile of coconuts. And then he uses all of his labor to go get a stick and sharpen it and construct like a long pole. okay? And then now that stick he has transformed into a capital good. Now it's a long pole, and he can go around whacking down, you know, hitting the coconuts down with the capital good. Okay, so in that context, you know, you've got saving and investment and the creation of capital goods, okay? But obviously there's not money, okay? So that's where the standard Austrian approach, that's how it works. That it's not thinking in terms of money, it's thinking in terms of real goods and services. So what Gene was saying there is just, you know, what would it mean for the economy to be more capital intensive in that sense? It would mean if there were more people walking around who knew computer programming, you know, had Linux skills or things like that, as opposed to, you know, a population with people who had no idea, or there was just one guy who knew how to program computers. There's a sense in which they would have less capital accumulation than an economy where, you know, there were millions of people who had gone through years of training and had years of on-the-job experience. Okay, so that's what Gene is getting at. Okay, so let me move on now, but I hope that it helps a little bit. Sorry, I think my sound went out, but now it's back. Does AP, MASH says, does, yeah, don't worry, people. When I have to scroll, I'm going to. Okay. Incidentally, my voice will come and go when I'm switching the questions, and it's just a problem because the way Jeff switched it over, I'm having to hold down the talk button. It's like a walkie-talkie. Okay, so normally that's not like that, but the way that this meeting got off to the way it was set up is that's what's happening. So when I scroll, I'm taking my hand off the button. So that's what's happening. Okay, if Hayek can't necessarily be considered one who relies on a priorism, how does he justify his deductive reasoning to explain his theory of the trade cycle? And that's from Garrett Smith. Well, I get what Hayek would do, I think, is he would say, look, I'm doing what other sort of empirical economists do, that I have a logical theory that makes sense. That Hayek talks about the pure logic of choice. So it's not that Hayek is against logical deductions from premises. No, he wants to do that. Like, if you want to start out and just do a thought experiment and say, let's imagine entrepreneurs are like this and interest rates change and what would happen. But then he wants to say, you know, there's only so much you can get from logical deductions, and then in order to grapple with the empirical elements, you need to open your window and look out. All right. So, as far as intertemporal coordination, Hayek's big thing was in one of his famous essays, is he said that, you know, the pure logic of choice really only. And by pure logic of choice, what Hayek meant was thinking through the implications of the fact that people have means and ends and they try to satisfy their wants. So that's what Hayek had in mind. He was saying the way they achieve equilibrium with each other, that is an empirical proposition. Okay, that so yes, you can say, you can have all kinds of truisms or true tautologies about what would happen if someone has goals in mind, and then he tries to grab means to achieve them. But then Hayek thought, when you start talking about 1,000 people put together in a city and how they interact with each other and how their knowledge changes based on observing what someone else is doing, and then talking about how do their plans come into coordination with each other, Hayek thought that's not just a pure armchair thing. You just can't sit back and reason your way through how that's going to happen. That you need to look at the real world, and that's an empirical question. Okay, so that was that's the difference between Hayek and Mises. For our purposes, I don't want to get too deep into that, but let me just remind you guys, I think it was in one of the readings, that Hayek and Mises did work on a foundation or a center to study business cycles, and they weren't just cranking out tautologies. I mean, they were looking at data and things like that. So it wasn't that Mises was against empirical investigation, it was just Mises really stressed the fact that in terms of pure economic theory, that is not you don't learn that by go testing things, that you have that through logical introspection. Okay, let me, you know what I'm going to do is, instead of taking my hand off and trying to scroll back and then losing the sound, I'm just going to read these things. So if you have posted one earlier, like I know I started to read one from someone called Mash, please wait until I finish a question, then go ahead and repost that, okay? But right now we've got at least three on deck. So if you guys can just hold off, because again, when you post, it moves up on my screen and then it bumps it off if I'm reading it. Okay, so why don't you guys just hold off and let me answer these, and I'll try to speed up my answers to get as many of you as possible. And then once I answer like Wombat's question here, then you know if you guys can post a few more. Okay, so Brian Bergfeld asks, why do lenders not demand an inflation premium when the Fed increases the money supply, which would offset the inflation-related decrease in interest rates? Okay, so this is basically the rational expectations objection. Okay, and we will specifically come back to this later in the course. You know, once we lay out the basics of the theory, we're going to specifically go through objections from other schools or rival explanations. So we'll come back to this. Right now, let me just give you the quick answer. Well, there's at least two separate answers, and this came up in the Monday lecture for those of you who were there. This similar question. So the issue is, you know, why are the Austrians saying that the lenders are just dumb and they can't see what the Fed is doing? And there's two things that, on the one hand, it's sort of an incentive problem that even if everybody knows Austrian business cycle theory, if the Fed comes in and starts lending out money at lower rates, you know, you can't all just say, no, we're not going to take that money because it's not real, because that money's just as real as all the other fiat money in everybody's wallet. Okay, so there's a sense in which even if everyone knows full well what's going on, the Fed is going to change the interest rate, right, because it's increasing the supply of fiat money on that market. And then the issue is, well, why don't people just perfectly offset it? You know, why don't they say, okay, yes, the nominal market rate went down because the Fed dumped a bunch of new money in the credit markets on the supply side, but why doesn't everyone take that into account and just perfectly offset it? So if they say, you know, this project right now is profitable at 3%, and right now interest rates are 3%, but I know really interest rates ought to be 5%, but it's because of the Fed. If you start, so that's plausible to, you know, in a sense, but to really say that entrepreneurs could do, therefore interest rates don't serve a purpose, right? If entrepreneurs could just back out the effect of what the Fed was doing, then in a sense you're saying they really can control all the different factors in the economy or account for them and know what the market rate's supposed to be. So let me say it a different way. We think as Austrians that prices communicate information, they help people coordinate. And so in addition to everything else people know, so entrepreneurs already have access to the raw data, if you will. They can, you know, look at the statistics and things, but then the market price itself is a new piece of information, right? It gives them something new over and above the stuff that the central planners would have access to. Okay, so if we're saying that market prices contribute something, then it has to be the case if the Fed screws up the market price that distorts things. All right, so last point is, you're right, people can build an inflation premium, a price inflation premium, and they do. But again, the issue is, I mean, they might overshoot or they might undershoot. We'll talk about this later, that one possible answer is, you know, some people might say not every injection of new money is going to an unsustainable boom. So that's one possible route an Austrian could take. Okay, that to say, yes, if you have this unsustainable boom, that could have caused it. Anytime the Fed injects money, maybe sometimes the entrepreneurs aren't cool. That's one thing you might say. And as Mises and Rothbard say, with free money, which leads to sound money, there would be no boom and bust. Would this still be true with technological disruptions or irrational banks with too optimistic lending practices? Okay, I guess what you're saying is if you had, you know, no government the monetary and banking arena, and you just had free competitive banks, you know, would there be no boom-bust cycle? Well, again, this is something we'll come back to later once we have more of the theory under our belts, but for right now, let me just give you a quick survey of what the answers could look like. So one of, because I don't want to, you know, I have my own views on these things, but I don't want to tell you this is the correct answer, because Austrians might differ depending on who you ask. So let me just try to give you a flavor of what some of the typical responses would be. So one thing would be to say, yes, that if you had these banks that could issue even fiat money, because Hayek believed, or he wrote about a system where privately, or banks and other organizations could be in competition with each other issuing fiat money, but with no special government privileges, right? So I could just start printing these things called the Murphy note, and if people started trading them and they became a medium of exchange, you know, Hayek thinks, well, that's great. And then, you know, he talked about what the incentives would be so that I wouldn't overissue those things. And he argued that just like, you know, the private sector with competing firms could make cars better than a central government monopoly, by the same token, Hayek thought it might not be that fiat money per se is bad, it's just you don't want to have a government monopoly of that. And so in that sort of world, yeah, if a bunch of the banks all inflated at the same time, then you would get a boom-bust cycle, because, you know, that's just the same thing as if the government did it. But the point is, the incentives would be there to really check that, that you probably wouldn't get all the banks in unison inflating at the same time, because they're, that just, you know, one of them would hold back and then win over the customers of the other banks when they went belly up because of bank runs. Okay, so the whole point, the whole reason the bankers went to the government to get a central bank is because they needed a cartel enforced by the government so they could all inflate together, and the government could eliminate the market's normal tendency to put a stop to that. Okay, so that's one way I would answer that. Another way, I think a more Rothbardian answer would be to say, you know, in a truly libertarian, or a society where the libertarian principles were largely respected, a bank would have to be 100% reserve. Otherwise, it would be engaging in fraud. And so in that sense, you couldn't have banks over-issuing. And if they were, they would be breaking the libertarian law. And so that would be like saying, you know, would there not be, you know, you could say, in a free society, could there be widespread war or widespread deaths the way there is during government-sponsored wars? And you could say, yeah, in theory, a bunch of private people could just go nuts and start killing each other. But you can see how in a, you know, free society, that would be clamped down upon, where it takes the government to really get involved to get millions of people to try to slaughter each other. So it's the same thing here. Okay, let's see. Wombat says, I know it is early to ask this, but are we going to cover how investors would be able to know in advance whether the interest rates are supported by real savings as opposed to artificially expanded credit? Okay, you guys who are on hold here, feel free at this point if you want to, like, try to get three more questions up on deck here. Okay. Yeah, Wombat, it's... Yeah, to answer your question, we'll certainly look into that. And also, remember, going forward on any given week, I'll have at least, what does it work out to be, an hour and 45 minutes of Q&A after the Monday lecture, and then another 2 hours during the normal office hours. And plus, I'm popping in and out of the forums. And you can always send me email, okay? So, for sure, if you want me to address that at some point during these 9 weeks, I'll get to that. I don't know that we'll cover it in terms of me officially teaching it to the class, just because that's a little bit obscure. Okay, let me keep going here to try to accommodate as many of you as possible. So Sean says, and please everyone hold off now on the questions because my thing is filled up now. I'll let you know when you can go ahead and post more. Thanks. Okay, so Sean Kennedy says, the ABCT, is there any way to soften the bust phase? This is what the UK government, amongst others, wants to achieve. In reality, does the market just have to render its verdict in its own way? Okay, that's a good question. So, for sure, what the standard Austrian would say is, no, during the bust, you don't want to cushion the blow or provide a soft landing by inflating again. You don't want the central bank to lower interest rates again to try to ease the pain or anything like that, because then you're just, you know, sowing the seeds for another boom bust. Okay, so what most people in the mainstream media think of as, you know, providing loose policies or easy policies, the Austrian would say, no, you're just making it that much harder for the market to adjust. Also, you know, deficit spending, most Austrians would say that also is silly, that the problem during the bust phase is the economy is reeling from the fact that everyone's realizing all the mistakes they made during the boom, and you don't help matters by the government coming in and, you know, stealing, if you're a libertarian, stealing a bunch more resources and then wasting them on uses that, you know, their private owners would not have diverted them to. Okay, so now I know that's probably not what you meant, but so those are the standard ways of helping. Of course, Austrians would say, no, you're just hurting things. But let's say Ron Paul wins the election and there's a, you know, big boom, a bust in process. What would I have advised that he do? Well, yeah, he could cut taxes, cut spending, you know, get rid of government regulations, things like that. So it's not that there's something peculiar to the bust phase that you would go ahead and do as a government or as advisor to the government. I mean, those things would have been good to cut taxes and cut spending and regulations even during the boom phase. Okay, so what's happening during a bust, the only thing that makes it special is that a lot of people all of a sudden realize at roughly the same time, oh my gosh, my plans were based on erroneous information. I'm not nearly as wealthy as I thought I was 3 months ago. And so when a lot of people in the economy all realize that at the same time, that's what the bust is. And then they adjust to it. And so business people start laying off workers because they realize, you know, they're not going to be able to sell the products the way they thought they were and so forth. And people cut back on their spending because they realize their wealth is not what they thought it was. So that's really the special aspect of a bust. And so the way you fix that is whatever would increase wealth or increase prosperity. Those things are true in normal times too. It's just they're especially important during a bust. Okay, Lee Sutterfield asks, you mentioned in a post that capital structure is perhaps the most distinctive aspect of Austrian economics. Could you expand that thought? Yeah, so just to get everyone up to speed, in one of the forum discussions, for the purposes of this class, probably the most distinctive element of Austrian economics is its capital structure or its approach to capital theory. So I'm not saying in the scheme of things that purpose of this class, I would pick one that. So and the reason I said that was simply to tell the Austrian story of the business cycle, you're going to need to have different stages of production. You're going to need to be able to talk about lower interest rates, not merely fueling investment or causing people to consume, which it does. That's you're setting in motion something that's going to make the economy end up in an unsustainable configuration. The only way that even makes sense is if you have a pretty complicated capital structure where, you know, you have goods in process and it's got to be, you know, something that takes years to complete. If you don't have the right amount of complementary parts for year two that are in motion so that when the stuff matures, you know, from year four to year three, consumption, you don't have the same Okay, I'm sorry about that. I think it's back now. Okay. That was just my finger got sore or got tired and it slipped off the button. Okay, sorry about that, everyone. And I don't think this will happen again. This is an unusual thing just because of the hijinks in the beginning and the way that I'm now the presenter. For some reason, my audio is not automatically on. Okay. No, that's not a good idea. So Peter Jan asking me to put something heavy on the button because it's my laptop. So, okay. And Peter Jan, that was the second question you've asked now. Okay. So can you, let's see. Can I go over? Oh yeah. Okay. Let me repeat what I just said about capital structure because I'm not sure when you guys lost me. Okay. And I'll keep it brief. And then sorry. Everything scrolled off the page, so if you guys can light up some new ones. Just two more, please, and then I'll come back. Okay, so the capital structure, the Austrian distinction is stages of production. And so you have goods in process, okay, and you have like a fifth order good, meaning that it's five stages away from consumption. But when you think about it, it's not just that there's the Austrians don't merely say that there's these five different stages, but there's other goods that come in and go out. So that, you know, if you're talking about tin that needs to get processed, well, at some point somebody has to use tools, and those tools also are multi-stage things. Okay, and so all these things have to come together, and it's a very complicated story, and that's why the Austrians, at least conceptually, can talk about the economy getting into an unsustainable configuration. Okay, whereas in the mainstream framework, where they have a much simpler approach to capital, where it's just a capital K, for example, or even if it's just a bunch of things, it's still a static, it's just every time period they can just enumerate, well, how many different, you know, items do we have, right? They might like have a list of goods, capital goods, you know, with subscript 1 through subscript 100, but they don't have them arranged in a temporal order. So it's not like they say, oh, this is a third order good, so this is more remote from consumption than this other thing over here that's a second order good. So because of that, the mainstream economists, when you talk about there being malinvestment, and you say the economy got into an unsustainable configuration, they're not even thinking of it the same way the Austrians are, because the mainstream economist, his notion of capital is so much, I don't want to say weaker, but shallow. It's more shallow than the Austrian view. Okay, so there's other areas maybe of economic theory where mainstream economists go much deeper than the Austrians, but on capital theory, clearly the Austrians have the deepest conception, at least compared to, you know, standard schools of thought like the monetarists and the Keynesians. And so that's why, in terms of Austrian business cycle theory, I would say if I had to pick one area, it would be capital theory is what really makes the Austrians stand apart. Okay, Floyd says, if money isn't wealth, what is, and how does it matter? Okay, and let's hold off on the new questions right now, guys, because you're knocking off the other people's. Okay, so if money isn't, so it's true, yeah, money is not wealth. Generally, wealth is just material things that have market value, is the way I tend to think of it, at least off the top of my head. All right, so well, we're in an economic context. I mean, if you want to get metaphorical and say, you know, if you have your health or if you have children who love you, then you're a wealthy man indeed or something like that. Okay, I don't mean that. I mean in an economic context to say, you know, what does it mean if a society becomes wealthier? I'm roughly have in mind that the physical things are that have market value are accumulating. Okay, and that so a given business enterprise, you can talk about how much wealth does it have. Basically, you know, you're saying what's its net worth. So from an individual business enterprise point of view, the more money, the more cash it has, actually, that is wealth, right? Like you as an individual, if you have a bunch of $100 bills in your closet, well, that's part of your total wealth. But in terms of, you know, the society as a whole, just having more money doesn't make the society wealthier. Okay, Mark McGrath has a quick one. Would you please share your views on the rap video, pros, cons, etc.? Well, the rap, let me just be honest with you guys, and I can't explain it. The first time I saw that rap video, I thought it was nerdy, okay? So, and I don't know if it was just because I didn't click on it at first. Like, I saw people alluding to it, like I saw different people blogging about it and just, you know, singing its praises, and I'm kind of a cynical person and a contrarian. And so I think I went in wanting to not like it, and I came out not liking it. And then I think it was Jeff Tucker who just totally turned me around, and he just went through it in one of his blog posts saying it was the most amazing thing ever. And I was reading what he was saying. I was like, yeah, that's true. So I can't explain it. You know, maybe deep down I was just jealous. I have no idea. So the rap video, it's incredibly well done from a technical point of view, meaning, you know, it's not like they dumbed down a bunch of stuff and, hey, it's entertaining, but actually you don't want to study it, you know, for a serious lecture. I mean, it's incredibly accurate as far as what they cover. And, you know, I'm not a Keynesian, so I can't say whether a real Keynesian would think he was misrepresented, but they did try to be fair, I believe. So, in any event, that's, yeah, for whatever reason, initially, I thought it was real nerdy and that no one was going to like it except for, you know, the choir, but obviously I was completely wrong, and so in that respect, I think what happened is I didn't realize how useful it would be in the classroom. Right, that I was picturing, well, if someone who didn't know about economics, if you sent it to him, that video wouldn't really teach him Austrian business cycle theory because it was a little bit too, you know, over their heads, and it certainly wouldn't convince, like, Paul Krugman. And so that's why I was thinking, you know, what is this except a very expensive, you know, way to high-five each other? But again, I was totally overlooking the fact that there's professors could show it to their classes the way we're doing now in this class. So anyway, that's, and John Popola, He was great. We saw him at the Austrian Scholars Conference, and he was great. Okay. Stephen F. Davis says, in Dan Mahoney's explanation, he says that holding cash is not a form of saving. Can you clarify this point? Okay, I would need to, and let's hold off on the new questions, please, guys, because you're bumping people off. I would need to go reread Dan Mahoney, so I don't want to comment. I don't want to be talking about what Mahoney thinks because I need to go reread it. Let me just say some general remarks on that. There's a little bit of ambiguity in Rothbard, and I got into an argument. If you guys know Robert Wenzel, he runs the website Economic Policy Journal. He and I got into an argument like 6 months ago. And just for your own reference, don't get into a public argument with Robert Wenzel because he has more time than you, and he will... he will win on his site, no matter what you say. So that's just my advice to you. The issue was, if people are accumulating cash, is that a form of savings? And I was arguing that it was, because I was thinking in terms of, you know, you have income coming in, and you could consume it, or you could take it, and you could, you know, not consume it, so that's saving, and then you invest it in various forms of financial assets. So clearly, you know, if you earn $100,000 from your job and you go spend $80,000 on rent and food and cars and stuff like that, that's consumption. And then with the other $20,000, if you go buy stocks with it, and so now you have a bunch of stock certificates to your name, you clearly invested that. So that was savings, right? And so I was saying, but what if I'm bearish on the stock market here, and so I invest in $100 bills and I just put those under my mattress? And to me, I thought that was really odd to say, oh no, that's just cash accumulation, that's not saving an investment. So, you know, and I thought I was on perfectly solid Austrian grounds for that, and I could point to passages in Mises and Rothbard. But then Wenzel came back and he pointed out passages in Rothbard for Man, Economy, and State where Wenzel thought he blew me up. And I have to admit, it did look like that. Like Rothbard was talking about that, you know, Rothbard was saying, you do the saving and the consumption decision, and that's one decision. And then, if you're holding cash balances, all your, you know, that's just the form of your, that you're holding your assets in, or something like that. And so it's just you know, if you want to have more liquidity or something like that, you would expand your cash, but that's not, you know, an extra form of savings. Okay, so I think that our two positions were actually compatible. And that the issue is just, it matters when you say, are you accumulating cash balances? If you're cashing out your 401k and turning it into cash, well, then that's not saving. You're just changing one form of savings into another one. Whereas what I had in mind was, if out of something that you might, you know, that you otherwise would have consumed, you instead grow your cash balances, I was going to say that's saving. So I hope that sheds light, and I would need to look at what Dan Mahoney said. Okay, Christian says, I understand Austrians are against the government subsidizing people saving for old age because any government intervention is more harm than good. Someone I told this protested that without these incentives, the damages would be far worse. Far less people would save, and society would have to deal with a great number of impoverished people. Okay, let me just answer this fairly briefly, since this isn't about Austrian business cycle theory per se. Well, first of all, you know, the if the government is subsidizing something, it's not making the economy richer, right? It's just taking money from some group and giving it to someone else. So if these people you're talking to are saying that, you know, one perhaps flip response is to say, well, if you want to give money to old people, you know, or tell them, or tell people right now, every dollar you save, I'll give you 10 cents, you can go ahead and do that with your own money, but don't use the government's guns to force me into your plan, which is what they're saying. They're saying, we think things ought to be this way, and we're going to use guns to force everyone else to do what we say, because we think we're right. So, I mean, that's one thing you can always say about people who want to have the government do something to make society better off. But as far as, you know, social retirement programs, I mean, I don't see how anyone can look at, in practice, what the governments have done, where, yeah, they force people to save, but then the government goes and borrows and spends that money. Okay, so all along, throughout the 20th century, well, since the 30s, workers have been saving having money taken out of their paychecks for Social Security, but typically the government just borrows that and spends it. So it's not that socially saving has increased, it's just the government has increased its borrowing to the extent that it's forcing people to save more. All right, so society is not growing richer, and so I think what would happen is, on a free market, people would actually, on net, actually save more. Okay, let's hold off on the questions now because you're bumping them all up again here. Okay, Joel says, the most recent boom was primarily evidence in government interventions. Devoid of such interventions, would a boom still lend to filter into one to few sectors of the economy, or would the boom be more spread out within the economy? Okay, let me just paraphrase. I think what you're saying is the housing boom was exacerbated by things like Fannie and Freddie and... what is that called? That the name's escaping me right now. The program to the Community Reinvestment Act, that sort of thing. And so yeah, the standard Austrian story tends to be the Fed, by pumping in new money and lowering interest rates, is going to cause a boom. But it depends on the particular circumstances as to which boom it's going to, where it's going to be, which sectors. So in the late 90s, it was internet stocks. After the NASDAQ bubble burst in 2000-2001, even though Greenspan pulled interest rates down, people were not going to flock back into tech stocks because they had been burned so recently. Okay, what they ended up doing was going into housing because they thought, erroneously of course, that, you know, oh, we don't want to go into this newfangled, you know, Amazon.com and all these internet stocks. Let's go into something traditional like housing and real estate, which, you know, is forever. It's a real thing. Real estate never goes down. So that's the mistake they made. And so now, presumably, you would hope investors, even though Bernanke has brought interest rates way down, they're not rushing back into housing, right? He's propped them up a little bit by other interventions, but it's clear that, you know, there's not this huge bubble right now, again, in U.S. housing. They're just trying to reinflate it. I would say right now there's a bubble in U.S. treasuries. I can't believe how low interest rates are on U.S. government debt right now, and I think that's going to explode. And 5 years from now, people are going to look back and be just as mystified as we are right now about what was happening to home prices in 2005. So to answer your question, I think what you're saying is, if you had a pretty much free market, except you had a central bank inflating, you know, would you just see the boom more evenly distributed because the government wouldn't be sort of funneling it into particular sectors? So if that's what you're asking, I don't know. I mean, that makes sense, but I could just as well say, I mean, like the tulip mania bulb, or the tulip bulb mania, I switched the words there, the tulip bulb mania, I would need to go reread Doug French's essay on that, but I don't know that there was a government program that pushed people into tulips. It could just be, you know, people grab... The thing with a bubble is, once it gets going, it feeds itself. Okay, so I think the idea is, I think most Austrians would agree with some version of what I'm saying here, that the government, you know, the central bank pumping in money into the credit markets is a necessary but not a sufficient condition. That for some reason, you know, something has to happen, and then a particular sector, once it takes off, everyone says, oh, that's the hot new thing. And then once you get rising asset prices, then you get speculators coming in who just buy just to hold it while the price goes up. So I think you would always have in a modern credit boom in a financial economy like ours, I think you're always going to have particular sectors start taking off. Now, it's true, if there's no government intervention, you know, maybe it's more random as to which sector happens to take off, but the point is, once it gets going, it snowballs. Okay, Kunal says, Robert, investing in stocks is not real wealth. When the stock market crashes, what happens to this wealth? Okay, I'm wondering, I guess you're probably going back to something earlier I said. I don't want to get too esoteric right now, but I think that would be I think it'd be hard for you to be able to justify that. I mean, I could say, look, there's, how can I put it? All wealth really is ultimately based on the market price, which is due to subjective expectations, right? So there could be a sturdy, brand new tractor, and we could think, now that's real wealth. You know, that thing's not going to collapse in price the way, you know, this stock in Goldman Sachs could just completely evaporate tomorrow, because this is a sturdy tractor. But if all of a sudden, you know, people don't want to smoke cigarettes anymore, and the price of tobacco just collapses, well, if that particular tractor was crop, well, then that the market price of that thing could collapse. Okay, so I get what you're saying, but by the same token, nothing is real wealth then, because everything could have a price of zero tomorrow if conditions change. Okay, so it's true, in our economy right now, our mixed economy, there's a lot of there's a lot of fishy things going on with the stock market, and I personally am totally out of the stock market, and I'm not going back in for a long time, if ever, at least in this country. Okay, so I agree with you, in the real world right now, people who talk about, you know, oh, put your money in a mutual fund and then you're safe, I agree those people are nuts, but I don't think it's because of stocks per se aren't real wealth. I think it's just because of this particular, you know, highly manipulated market. Okay, Wombats, let me skip Wombat because I think I already answered one of yours. Although you guys seem to be talking to each other. Okay. Well, George here, if you're still... Yeah, okay. Yeah, so a few of you go ahead and repost. And Wombat, if you're still around when this thing ends, I'll try to come back to you. Okay, but I'm trying to get people who are new. Jeremiah says, in the absence of a full reserve banking system, would the business cycle at least decrease if the Fed was robotically controlled? Okay. That's a good question. So, so Jeremiah is alluding to the fact, just to fill you guys in, that the monetarists and some other people picking up on the idea, what they recommend is, they say, part of the uncertainty of what happens with central banking is investors don't know what the Fed's going to do. Okay, so not only does the businessman have to worry about his customers and suppliers and things like that, but also he has to worry, you know, what's the Fed's policy going to be 2 years from now, 3 years from now? Okay, let's hold off on the questions, guys, if you can, because you're going to knock Greg's off the thing here. So what Milton Friedman said is, let's take that discretion out of it. Let's just have the Fed say, we're going to grow the money supply, you know, 2%. Every year, just no matter what, whether we're in recession, whether we're in hyperinflation, doesn't matter, the Fed always grows some monetary aggregate by the same set amount. And in fact, we don't even have a Fed chairman, we just have a robot that does it. And that would give certainty or predictability, at least on that aspect, and they think that that would smooth out the business cycle. So if your question to me is, would that help from an Austrian perspective, I would say yes, especially the lower that percentage is. The only problem is, because then you're at least, it gets predictable, and I think as we get later in the course, I think entrepreneurs largely could then offset, you know, some of the problems, the distortions, because they, once it became more predictable, it would be more obvious, you know, what portion of the interest rate, you know, the gap, in other words, between the actual market rate and what the natural rate is supposed to be, if that were always roughly the same, I think business people over time would get a better idea of what that was supposed to be. Not that they're thinking in terms of Austrian economists, but that they they would smooth those things out. The only problem is if the demand for money changes, then the monetarist rule, you know. So in other words, it's not that you're just doing the same amount of distortion every year if you always make the money supply grow by 2%, because what if for some reason people want to hold money, you know, that they want to increase their cash balances? Well, then, you know, it gets, if it were a true market-based money, people would go dig up more gold, and so that's, you know, the supply would increase. Okay, so that's why it gets really tricky when you try to lay down rules for what the Fed should do. Like, for even if the you might say, well, if they just don't inject any new money at all, well, again, that's not what the market would do, right? If we were on a true gold, you know, people had gold coins in their pocket, people would still be mining gold that would get turned into more money. So it's a little bit tricky. No, you know, you're not going to get a Fed that isn't screwing things up. Okay, let's see. I'm apologizing if I'm missing people who are getting knocked off, but it's hard for me to keep track of who's asking what. So let me just go ahead and ask the top one. Kunal says, Robert, how difficult would it be to go back on the gold standard? I don't know what you mean by, and you say, especially when the supply of gold is limited. I think it would be, sorry, I'm back now in case you lost my sound. I think it would be politically impossible to go back on the gold standard with any of the major governments right now, except if there was if the dollar crashes, which it very well might, then I could see like an Arab state, for example, getting a bunch of gold and then linking its currency to that. Okay, that might happen. Western nations, I mean, they designed this system on purpose. We didn't accidentally end up with fiat money, okay? So they don't like the gold standard. So they're going to do everything in their power to discredit it, and to make. I mean, even all these deficits and what have you. I mean, that's only going to be possible if they can print money ultimately. So I don't think they're going to go back to gold. But if they were to. If you're just asking a technical question, like let's say Ron Paul becomes president and he wants to do it, the when you say the supply of gold being limited, that's, I mean, there's always going to be a finite amount of gold in the world. Okay, so all that would do is change what the parity would be. Okay, so I don't think that the in other words, it's not like, yeah, the gold standard might work if we only had an extra 2 million tons, but since we don't, the gold standard won't work. I don't think that's an issue. They would just, if anything, just affect the exchange rate that you set between the dollar and gold. Okay, and again, sorry, people got knocked off here. Wombat says, can you recommend any other readings on the regression theorem? Yeah, but why don't you email me that question, okay, because off the top of my head. Okay, so just email me that. Garrett says, are business cycles... actually, let me answer Greg's first, because I think I skipped him before. Greg says, how does ABC address the issue of overlapping bubbles, since the Fed's interference continues even during the bust? Yeah, well, Mises talks about this a lot. It's just an issue of... the economy never fully cleanses itself of the previous mistakes, and then you just start a new boom afresh. And so I really think, this is my little pet theory, I haven't seen other people talk about this necessarily, but I was really intrigued to find, when I did the research for my book on the Depression, that the 1920 and 21 Depression there, if you go there, the Fed did the exact opposite of what, you know, it's supposed to do. It raised interest rates to record highs during that depression. All right, and so I think what happened there is, not only was the economy sort of fixing itself because everyone realized the mistakes of the wartime boom, but the Fed actually really did what it could in the sense of, and again, by jacking up interest rates, all that meant was it stopped injecting, you know, new money in, okay? And so interest rates rose to the actual market level or close to it, as opposed to the Fed injected a bunch of new money to try to ease things. And so I think because of that year or 6 months, whatever it was, of really high interest rates, it purged the system, that that people really, you know, people, businesses that were unsound just failed because they knew the jig was up. And the only businesses that remained were the ones that knew they had healthy long-term plans, and they were willing to borrow at the really high rates because they knew they could weather the storm. And so I think that laid the foundation for the Roaring Twenties. Right, so I don't think that's a coincidence that we had one of perhaps the most prosperous decade in U.S. history following a bust when the Fed let interest rates just skyrocket. So all that's to say that I think the reason we have these sluggish recoveries, like right now we have the jobless recovery, and in the you know, the Greenspan's recovery was again a jobless recovery, that I think the reason we have that is because the Fed is sowing the seeds for another boom, and the economy is not really getting able to correct the errors from the previous boom. Okay, Hussein, I haven't heard from you yet. I have heard that the Fed cannot influence the long-term bond rates. I was under the assumption that the Fed can purchase or sell government bonds in the credit markets. Are the only rates that the Fed can control the effective funds rate and the discount rate? Okay. Let me answer the last question first. You say, in which rate is implied in the Austrian business cycle theory? There's no definitive answer to that. I think if you ask different Austrians, they'd give you different rates. And part of it is just because the market has evolved. So when Mises was writing, you know, back in the 1920s and Hayek and so forth, I mean, the interest rates that they might have been talking about might not have been the analog of what today we would call the Fed funds rate. All right, so I think the way you would answer that would be a matter of applying the skill and using your judgment. And we'll talk about that more later in the class when we do the historical applications. We'll try to look at and see, you know, if you wanted to use real world data, what would you look at? Now, the other thing you asked is, some people claim that the Fed can't influence long-term rates. And what they mean there is, they're going to say, what the Fed does in standard textbook operations is it adjusts the supply of reserves, and technically that, by doing, you know, buying and selling assets, it's injecting or removing reserves, bank reserves from the system. And what the federal funds rate is, it's when one bank borrows reserves from another bank in an overnight loan. And the interest rate on that in an annualized percentage is what the Fed funds rate is. So right now, that's what the Fed uses. It targets that. And so that's the sense in which people say the Fed can't influence that. And they want to say long term, you know, there's things like inflation expectations and, you know, what's the real rate of growth going to be? So the idea is, if you're going to make a 10-year loan to somebody, you want to know, well, what's inflation and where interest rate's going to be over the next 10 years. And you want to say, well, if you're a mainstream economist, it's due to, you know, the real rate of return, like on investment, like what's the real accumulation to capital. And then on top of that, what are long-term interest rates? All right. And so a lot of people are going to say the Fed can only control that except insofar as it influences inflation, but by which they mean price inflation. I don't know. I mean, it's certainly true the Fed has more power over shorter rates than longer rates. That's certainly true, but I think like you were asking in your question, I mean, if the Fed wants to, and they've done this, they can just go out in the market and buy 30-year treasuries. All right, so the Fed can certainly, if it wants to, I mean, they can spend an infinite amount of money. So I think it's true in practice that the Fed tends to influence shorter rates more, but I think that's just because that's typically where the Fed has focused its efforts. That if the Fed wanted to, it could, you know, change the yield curve by just targeting the longer maturities. Okay, let me cater to George here, because I think I skipped him before. Bob, how I understood the proposal of Hayek to end the monopoly of state in the area of money. He didn't think that private banks would issue its own fiat money, but more likely that there is a point of no return. Gold or other commodities money, it will be... Okay. So, yeah, George is asking about Hayek. You might be referring to some other work that he has done, But Hayek, clearly, he does have a whole pamphlet. It's, the title of it is called The Denationalization of Money. And if you go to my Mises archives, I wrote about this. I think the title of the article is Hayek's Plan for Private Money, or maybe Hayek's Plan for Private Fiat Money, something like that. So if you go to my daily archives at Mises.org, and it's probably the only article that has Hayek in the title, now that I think of it. So if you go look there, I mean, I link to, you can see, I mean, it's I'm not putting words in his mouth. Hayek really does envision a system of competing issuers of fiat money. And it's a very interesting proposal. Okay, John T. is asking, okay, just so you guys know, I'll have to close the questions this way. I'll answer the ones that are sitting up here on the screen, but by my clock, we need to end, you know, pretty soon. So let me just wrap this up. And again, let me just do the housekeeping announcement. I'm always available if you want to send email or within the Academy framework. If you send me, you know, the messages in there, I see them. Or on this coming Saturday, available, you know, so the lecture will go an hour and 15 minutes, and then you'll have me for the full 3 hours at that point too. Okay, but for right now, again, I have the tea party deal. I have to leave first thing in the morning tomorrow, so I have to go get ready for that. So let me just, Nowak here will be the last one. Okay, and then I'm gonna leave, and if you guys are still, I don't know if Jeff is still gonna be here, so you can see if he wants to keep this thing open, if you want to chat, but I'm gonna leave after I answer Nowak's here. Okay, so John T. says, did any Austrians predict the Asian crisis of a few years ago? Well, for sure, some people who are in the Austrian framework, you know, would have said, I predicted that. But then a critic could say, well, what do you mean? And, you know, you have this issue, like, ever since 1971, a lot of Austrians and libertarians have been saying, you know, we're all dead because, you know, now our money doesn't mean anything. And so, in that respect, a lot of people, you know, and whenever there's a crisis, will say, you know, we told you so. If you want to say, okay, but let's be a little bit fairer, you know, to the outside people who think that we're wrong or that don't believe in our theory, you know, did someone specifically predict the crisis? I'm trying to remember. I was looking through some of Ron Paul's older speeches. Don't quote me on this, but I kind of want to say that Ron Paul did call that, like in some of his old testimony, congressional testimony, but I might be getting mixed up. But he, for sure, he had some very prescient things to say, and I think it was even about the Asian crisis, to be honest with you. Okay, but again, I don't know for sure. Okay, Garrett says, are business cycles talked about possible in a barter economy? Huh. That's a really interesting question. I would have to think about that, and I'm guessing I've never heard anyone talk about that. My guess would be no, but maybe someone will bring something to my attention. But yeah, that's a really interesting question. Let's see. Sorry, I wish I could say something more. Your question's more profound than my answer, but no, off the top of my head, I've never heard someone talk about that. You know, I take that back. Hayek, when he's arguing with Sraffa, Piero Sraffa, there's a thing in there where Sraffa is criticizing Hayek. I would get real technical if I tried to answer that right now. So, Garrett, if you can email me that question, I'll answer it more, or maybe I'll post something on the Academy site for those who are interested, and I can give you the links. But Hayek and Sraffa did argue about that, but it would be too esoteric for me to talk about right now. So yeah, it had to do with a wheat economy and with wheat futures and what's the internal rate of return on wheat and so forth. Okay, Dan says, is there any way or can you give any scenario that the inflation we have created will not lead to double-digit inflation in the next 2 or 3 years? Yeah, sure. So if you're asking, is it possible we won't see double-digit inflation in the next 2 or 3 years? Yeah, I mean, anything's possible in that sense. Let's push it back and say, well, why haven't we seen it so far? I mean, the reason we, in other words, whatever forces or factors have kept it at bay so far could, in theory, keep it at bay for another 5 years. So I personally have actually been surprised at how low measured CPI inflation has been. Now, I've actually been a critic of the people saying we're on the edge of a deflationary cliff, because I pointed out that, you know, if you, I don't know if you guys can see my hand, you know, I'm not going to try to do that because I'm looking at the mirror image and I'm going cross-eyed. CPI fell sharply in the end of 2008, but then since then it's been growing at fairly normal rates. Okay, so when you saw these year-over-year comparisons of that looked like falling prices, that was misleading. Right. So we've had, I think the CPI just came out today, and I think the year-over-year was, it was 2 and change. It was 2%. It was 2 point something from, you know, last month to the previous 12 months. Okay, so that's you know, it's not hyperinflation, obviously, but it's also not price deflation, which is what a lot of people say that we're in danger of. So what's happening is, yeah, Bernanke has flooded the banking system with all these excess reserves, all right? But basically, that's all just bottled up in the banking system. The banks aren't lending that out, okay? And when we later in this course, a few weeks from now, we'll go over more specifically exactly what happens when the Fed buys assets, and then how does the bank create new money and that kind of thing. So this will make more sense. But that's the quick answer to your question is, all that money that Bernanke has created and injected into the financial system, it's basically just bottled up right now with the banks, and they're not lending it out. And so I think that's the main quick answer to your question. And remember, everyone keeps pointing to Japan. Japan had pretty big budget deficits and pretty large increases in its monetary base. Nothing like what Bernanke has done, but if you had showed me what the Japanese policies were, and then asked me, what do you think happened to their price level over this period, I would have thought they had high price inflation, but yet they didn't. So, you know, we have to be careful and not shoot our mouths off and then make a wrong prediction. Okay, Wombat, you're asking the main errors of the historical school. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to answer that right now. So if you want to email me that, I can give you more, but right now I'm not gonna answer that one. And then Noack, this is the last one, and then I have to close it off, guys. So again, for people who were jumping around, this Noack question is the last one I'm gonna do, and I have to go, but I will be able to answer email and things like that. Or Saturday, I'll have a long Q&A session after the repeat lecture one. Okay, so Noack says, how is the ABC's view on that? Government controls the prices on oligopoly and monopoly company. Okay, I think what you're asking me is, I'm not sure what you're at. Let me just rephrase it and then answer what I think you're saying. You're saying, like, does the Austrian business cycle theory have a position on the issue of government controlling the prices on oligopoly and monopoly companies? Well, in a Rothbardian framework, the very terms of oligopoly and monopoly don't mean anything in a free market context. Okay, so the mainstream criteria for what's an oligopolistic industry or a monopolistic industry, that Rothbard, in my mind, pretty conclusively blows that stuff up in Man, Economy, and State. So in that respect, no, you the Austrians don't want government trying to control prices in those arenas. And but that kind of stuff doesn't really have too much bearing on Austrian business cycle theory. I mean, generally, those are two separate areas, at least as far as the Austrians are concerned. So they don't overlap too much. Okay, all right, guys, I'm going to need to take off now. Thank you for tuning in, and I hope I answered some of your questions. And again, if I didn't get to your question tonight, just bear with us. I will have longer sessions in the future. Okay, so again, I'm always, email me. If you do email me, make sure in the body of your email the word Academy is in there somewhere, because I've got my Gmail account with a filter set up so that when it comes in, I see it's from one of you guys. Okay? All right, so thanks, guys, and I'll talk to you later.